Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, October 7th, 2024. My name is Magnus Stevens. I'm your host for today. And joining me in the studio today is...
It's Peter R.H.
And we have a good show for you. We're going to start off with an interview with Leslie McBain, who's one of the co-founders of advocacy group Mom Stop the Harm. And they are a group advocating on behalf of drug users and drug users' families and do a lot of work on advocating for drug policy. And we're going to talk about... the provincial election and some of the policies put forth by the various parties on the issue. And yeah, it's a really interesting conversation that'll be coming up in just a couple moments. Peter, what are you going to chat about today?
We're going to talk about 1936 film Things to Come. Now, the father of one of the co-architects of Simon Fraser University, Gerald Massey. Anyway, his father was after me, Raymond Massey. Mm-hmm. And this is a really odd film. It's about the future. It ends in 2036, so it still is. But I don't think it's going to wind up the way they say in the film. But I'll talk about it and bring up the book that it was based on, a 1933 H.G. Wells book. It's actually it's always credited that H.G. Wells wrote the screenplay for this film, but he wrote 3 years before the film came out a novel with the same title that ends in the year 2106.
Yeah,
and it has a few other changes to it.
Great. Sounds interesting. Sounds like we'll have a fun time with that one. We also have Gardening with Embark, and we're going to be talking about how you can get your indoor garden started now that we're heading into the fall, into the fall season, and you're winding up your outdoor gardening. So that'll be fun. And Stephen Fan may be here. I'm not 100% sure. But we're expecting him to drop by and talk a bit about what he's been checking out at the Vancouver International Film Festival. Today is October 7th. That makes it the one-year anniversary of the Hamas attacks on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and took another over 200 hostage and set in motion all the events of the past year that we have... witnessed in our TV news every evening. We've seen protests around the world against the Israeli assault into Gaza. And more recently, we have seen the expansion of the war with Hamas shooting rockets, or not Hamas, but Hezbollah shooting rockets from southern Israel into Israel. From southern Lebanon into Israel. Sorry about that. We've seen the Israelis respond first with airstrikes, now with a limited ground invasion, retaliatory attacks on Iran, and Iran launching a couple drone and missile attacks on Israel. And who knows where this is all going to end up, but what we do know is after a year of conflict, there are tens of thousands of people dead, and the death toll seems like it's only going to go on and on.
Well, hopefully something... I mean, they'll win in some way. With the state of it, Israel will win in some way because the other side really can't win. But, I mean, I think... I don't know if they are doing what is the minimal response?
Yeah,
I think that's what's demanded, and they could well be doing it. But I think the problem has come from a optics perspective. Is sort of at times a perceived gloating of like Israel or whatever it may be. I mean, it's been maybe they are doing the right procedure, but it hasn't looked good for them in some quarters.
No, I think I think definitely it has not looked good, especially with the high death toll from their actions.
Yes,
I mean, my feeling about it is that there really isn't a military solution to this overall situation.
I would go along with that myself.
And so, you know, pursuing some of the goals of destroying Hamas in Gaza and elsewhere, destroying Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, aren't really realistic. And pursuing them as aggressively as they have and in such an ongoing way still isn't going to achieve their stated aims. And we're going to end up with a lot of dead people. Hamas and Hezbollah themselves can't really claim to be victims, but there's a ton of civilians who have inevitably gotten in the way just by living their lives. And it doesn't seem that's going to change, you know. And unfortunately, there isn't a lot of interest on any of the sides towards a realistic negotiated solution. I mean, I think a solution probably exists, but I don't think the parties either on any side are really wanting to make the compromises that would require. And part of the reason that happens is because, of course, because of all the conflict and all the killing and all the need for whether you want to call it vengeance or, you know, giving back what they got, it's the conditions aren't there for people to make the kind of compromises that might actually be needed to achieve peace. We're left with war.
One quick thing I'll add. I think the rest of the Islamic world could be acting a bit better, taking the Palestinians in. Yeah. That's just a quick comment to say how I see the situation.
All right. Well, Stephen Fan is here, so we're going to be hearing from about VIF a little later in the program.
Absolutely. Is this thing on?
Yes, it is. You can tell when it's on when you wear your headphones.
Oh, wonderful.
Awesome secrets. Okay, well, yeah. Glad you're here, Steve. We're going to get on with our first segment. This is Leslie McBain, co-founder of Moms Stop the Harm, talking about the drug crisis and the provincial election and the policies that the various parties are putting forth.
We got dead air problems here.
No. It's not so much that as there's some other stuff here, so I'm having to do things in non-usual ways. But here we are. Sorry. Here is our interview with Leslie McBain. It really just wants to play that
good
one
morning,
segment.
And thank you for joining us here on the program. Joining me now is Leslie McBain, who's co-founder of Mom Stop the Harm. Perhaps you can introduce yourself and tell us a bit about Mom Stop the Harm.
Of course. My name is Leslie McBain. I, with two other women, co-founded Mom Stop the Harm back in early part of 2016. We had all three of us lost our sons to drug harms, and we sort of serendipitously found each other and decided these deaths were not only tragic and heartbreaking and changed our lives, but they were also preventable. So we worked hard, and within a year we had really created Mom Stop the Harm with a website and with contacting different people that we knew and media as well. And today we're somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 members across across Canada. Our primary goal in creating the organization was to advocate for better drug policies that actually support and save the lives of people who use drugs. And we have branched out we now have support groups for two types of support groups. One for families who have lost a loved one to the drug harms, and another group of support groups for people who have a loved one still struggling. So we're busy, and we're in it for the long haul.
It really sounds like, you know, when you started up the group, that it really filled a hole that wasn't being filled by other groups.
Exactly. We were one of the first, well, certainly family-oriented, and we're the only one of the only family-oriented advocacy groups in the country. There's a couple more back east who we've certainly aligned with and have kept in communication with. But so here in the West, especially, well, Manitoba to BC, we are the we have the loudest voice, let's just say.
Right. So we're heading into a provincial election. We're only 2 weeks away now, and the drug crisis and drug policy is taking a forefront in this campaign. What do you see as the most important issues regarding the opioid crisis and for the community in this election?
Well, I think the first priority, which should be just, you know, so visible to everyone, is to keep people alive, to keep people who use drugs, who do not have a safer supply, which is most of the drug users in this province, to keep them alive, to keep them safe from the horrendously toxic street market of the drugs that on which they are dependent. So that is number one priority. These are preventable deaths, as I've said, and the governments, all governments in the last 20 years have not attended to the fact that if people were able to access a safe, regulated, prescribed supply of the drugs that they need, they would stay alive. They wouldn't be dying. We wouldn't have the criminal justice system always involved. We wouldn't have tremendous ER visits. The list goes on. It's the humane thing to do. So that's the top priority, I would say. Secondarily, our concern is both the Liberals and the Conservatives have discussed or talking about in their platform, secure or coerced care for people who are addicted, but also people with complex needs, such as mental health issues, as well as addiction. And we firmly are not in agreement with coerced care. So those two are primary for our advocacy. And we understand the problems around public safety and the concerns of the public there. But we think that these can be resolved in better ways than just locking people up.
So in the last year, we've seen a bit of a shift in sort of the policy direction that's been happening. It seems, for a period of time before that, we seem to be moving forward into, what seem to be helpful policies, whether it's safe injection sites and decriminalization. And some of that started to be rolled back. Part of what seems to go on is there's a lot of fear among the public about these policies. And there's a bit of a willingness to step forward, and then there's a stepping back. We advanced on decriminalization, and that's been rolled back a bit. There's increasing opposition to safe injection sites, including the Conservatives. Their policies is to eliminate them. Mm-hmm. How do we combat that kind of fear? Because that seems to be one of the biggest stopping points from a political perspective of moving forward on a lot of policies that would help solve the crisis.
Mm-hmm. It is fear-based. These are political manipulations. We've had safe consumption sites since Insight 20 years ago was opened, and thousands of lives have been saved. But what has happened is the rhetoric around them has shifted to something that isn't actually truthful. It's been called, I think, by John Rusted and by Pierre Poilievre, these have been called drug dens, which is, if it weren't so ugly, it would be funny. People who use drugs at safe consumption sites first of all, are safe. They don't die. And second of all, they're offered, given lots of references, lots of possibilities for recovery, for medical attention, and so on. They're absolutely necessary, yet they've been characterized in a way that is, again, fear-based, and that people just think this is, that we're, I guess, an old-fashioned word, mollycoddling people who use drugs. It's just not the case.
So one of the big policy moves recently has been around involuntary treatment. What is the reasons you are opposed to it? Because, from, I think, what many people would see is that lots of folks out there don't seem to be in a position to make good choices for themselves through their addiction or circumstances or mental health. And maybe there needs to be some intervention. So why do you feel it's not a good policy?
Well, first of all, it's quite unclear exactly what either of the parties that are advocating for this kind of program. It's not clear what they mean. The devil's in the details in this. Mm-hmm. Coerced care, involuntary care for people who are addicted, let's just stick with that for the moment, has never proved to have great success. And that's not just here, but that is globally. Countries where coerced care has been implemented see that after a person comes out of that recovery type of facility are very vulnerable. The reasons for their drug use in the first place have not been attended to properly or on a long-term basis. And they come out and they generally, people want to go back to their old ways because they're not, well, certainly in the case of BC, if people do go into involuntary care and they come out drug-free, do they have a job? Do they have housing? Do they have support? Do they have ongoing treatment with counseling, for instance? No, they don't. And that's even with voluntary care. With involuntary care, people often, especially youth, I would have to add, come out mistrusting a system that would throw them into a locked facility and try and make them better without their consent. It just breeds mistrust in an already shaky system. So we're really against, and if I could just go on a little bit about that, what it seems like what both these parties' platforms have done is ignore the first part of the spectrum of this, wherein people would have a safer prescribed supply so they can stabilize, could get into an evidence-based treatment facility, would have those ongoing supports. That isn't present, and it's only a tiny percentage of people who can access that. But these two parties have gone right to the other end of the spectrum saying, well, let's just lock them up. That is not the way for success, nor is it humane, nor is it going to keep anybody safe. They can't keep people forever. And I will grant you, of course, and I agree with this, people who, as we already know from the Mental Health Act, are a danger to themselves and others, can be incarcerated. I say incarcerated, can be put into secure care one way or the other. We need to stay safe. Neighborhoods have to be safe. But I think if these other things were in place, neighborhoods would be safer. So it's just the platform is just a sort of a easy and manipulative way to let the public think things will be better and people will be safer.
So what are the policies you'd like to see supported by the parties and put into action mm-hmm. here?
Yeah, the Green Party actually has, we're almost 100% on the same page as the Green Party. First of all, increasing and broadening and strengthening the programs for a regulated pharmaceutical supply of drugs for people who are addicted or dependent. That's the first step. Rather than pulling it back, rather than dispensing with this whole thing, actually making it better, making it more accessible, low barrier to people, keep them safe, keep them alive. The building out of different types of government, not private, but government facilities for recovery. And that means evidence-based. That means meeting the person's individual's needs and providing the supports that are necessary for them to stabilize and have full lives. And it's a tall order, but what I always say is, it's not impossible. And if it's not impossible, it is possible with the right priorities, with the right funding, with the right professionalism. That is the answer. That is not what we're seeing here. We're seeing fear, sort of fear trumping evidence. We need the evidence-based ways to go forward to keep people alive and recovered.
The Conservative Party and John Rusted are promising to shut down safe injection sites if they come to power. What will the fallout be of such a policy?
Yeah, the fallout will be death. There's just no two ways about it. Safe consumption sites keep people from dying from the toxic supply. The toxic supply, of course, comes from organized crime. They're just forging ahead and making huge amounts of money and huge amounts of product that are toxic and often lethal. So if people who are dependent and who need, and people have to understand, the public has to understand addiction too. That's something I have to throw in there. So people go into safe consumption site, they are generally safe for those moments, and they go on in their lives, whatever those lives look like. Without safe consumption sites, people, again, and this is, you know, it's so ironic, because then the people who are unhoused, the most vulnerable of us, are forced to use in public or outdoors. And since decriminalization has been rolled back, so where people are not allowed to be in X, Y, and Z spaces, they're very, very vulnerable to not only to overdose and death, but to arrest. So closing safe consumption sites is absolutely going backwards. It is inhumane, and it shows very clearly that the people who are creating the rhetoric around this don't care very much about the human beings who are dependent on drugs.
Not that we want to make up drug policy on the fly, but it seems like decriminalization and safe injection sites are something that would work together, and that, you know, some of the challenges of decriminalization, such as, you know, people using in places that really make the public really uncomfortable, might be mitigated by a greater availability of safe injection sites.
Absolutely. If safe consumption sites the number of them was expanded, then yes, people have a place to go. As it is, as it stands right now, as we were just talking about, for people who are unhoused, they have no other place but to be out of doors. And this, the public doesn't like to see this. Safe consumption sites, as I said before, not only provide a safe space, the attention a person needs if they have a very bad batch of drugs in their possession, but they're also helped in many different ways, supported in different ways. I think the expansion of the role, the funding, first of all, and the role of safe consumption sites is one of the answers to this problem. I would love to see if safe consumption sites could be merged with safer supply programs. And, you know, I know there's always the geographic problems where people don't want to see these things in their neighborhoods. It is a challenge to find spaces where everybody feels safe. But again, if it's not impossible, then it is possible. It's just the matter of whatever government becomes in power. The Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions has to spend time and resources on not applying Band-Aids, but actually getting to the bottom of the problem which is support and attention and, well, housing, obviously, and the whole spectrum of needs that people have who are dealing with this disorder. Right now, the road to recovery that is offered through St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver is one of the most brilliant programs around. It should be expanded throughout the province, throughout the country, and it helps people go from one stage to the next, to the next. So it's the information and the evidence is there. It's clear, but people don't like to think about supporting, you know, their tax dollars or whatever going to helping people who are in this situation. I just say, learn what you can about addiction, about the challenges, about trauma, about mental health issues that need to be addressed. I wish the public would start to understand so they could be a little more empathetic and support some of these programs.
Are you able to rate the party's platforms with respect to the drug crisis, what they're proposing?
Well, I'd certainly say the Greens have it almost 100%. And between, you know, if I were to have a magic wand, I would obviously have the Greens in power. I think they're a lot of their platform is good in many other ways than just drug policy. Yeah. But the NDP, at least we've been working with the NDP for the last few years, and we have made some progress. So, you know, I'm not going to be specific here because I do see Premier Eby rolling back, you know, taking a little bit more of a right-wing stance on this and wanting to have involuntary care and seeing what has been proposed and what is actually, I think, legislation now on the decriminalization. Seeing him trying to step back on that it's really demoralizing in terms of, and anyway, I think we could still work. We, being the advocates who advocate for people to use drugs, yeah, could still work with NDP. Seems like the conservatives across the country and really even across North America don't understand, don't look at the evidence, only look at what is politically advantageous to them. You know, it's almost like to heck with people who use drugs. We don't care about them. We don't want to see them. We don't care if they recover or not. Let's just make them invisible. That seems to be what the conservatives are going with, you know, that everything is broken. We can't fix it. So let's just get them off the streets, lock them up, lock them up either in this involuntary treatment or stick with the criminal justice system, that pillar of enforcement. So it's difficult to see, and I don't know what will happen in the next, you know, in this next year.
We have a bit of time left before the election. Mm-hmm. What questions should listeners, people listening now, and voters be asking their candidates at events about this issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the questions that I asked when I went to a town hall meeting with our local candidate for MLA is I asked him what will the Conservative Party do if they get in power to mitigate the 6 to 7 deaths every day in this province? What will be the what's the plan? And he did not have an answer for me. Sorry, my parrot is in the background. And he couldn't answer me. And he said, well, I've answered that in my health plan. And I said, no, you didn't. And he actually just ignored me and went on to the next question. So I think that there's not an answer. They don't have an answer to the question of what to do today. They have all this sort of aspirational rhetoric around expanding treatment. And there's never been enough treatment facilities, and so there people should be asking the candidates what are you going to do, and then people should be asking themselves, is this reasonable, is this empathetic, is this humane, is this doable? And the answer will be no, in terms of certainly the Conservatives and maybe the NDP as well. People should really look at the Green Party platform on this.